Considering the hell Congressman Young has gone through over the past 5 years, he would not knowingly do anything that would violate House rules.
Questions over donations to Congressman Young's legal defense fund. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a plan to protect Alaska's oceans from acidification.
We can actually quantify what the cost of ocean acidification is today, what it'll be 10 years from now, and what it'll be 50 years from now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The Ethics Committee for the U.S. House is extending an investigation into possible violations by Congressman Don Young of Alaska. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
Monday's announcement was the first public confirmation that the ethics panel is probing into Congressman Young. The Ethics Committee is notoriously secretive about investigations. Its statement merely says it's extending the period of time it's taking to look into, quote, matters, and that the extension does not mean a violation has necessarily occurred. It now has until January 11th to decide how to proceed. Congressman Young's office says the investigation centers around donations made to his legal defense fund early this year and whether they exceed the legal limit on contributions. Young spokesman Luke Miller says the congressman has been proactive dealing with the allegations and that when the issue first came up over the summer, Young formally requested that the Ethics Committee look into it. Miller read from a prepared statement.
Considering the hell Congressman Young has gone through over the past 5 years, he would not knowingly do anything that would violate House rules. Congressman Young will continue to work with the Ethics Committee as they resolve this matter, and he is prepared to return any contribution that is deemed in excess of the limit.
Young was the subject of federal investigations on a number of fronts in recent years over alleged campaign contributions from corrupt VICO executive Bill Allen and an earmark called Coconut Road that was mysteriously inserted into a transportation bill and benefited a wealthy Florida developer and donor. Young announced last year that the Justice Department had ended its investigations. But the watch group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, wants to know more about the investigations into Young and has sued the Justice Department for access to its records. Executive Director Melanie Sloan says Monday's internal congressional investigation pales in comparison to past accusations.
In truth, this is just not, to my mind, anywhere near the biggest ethics issue that Don Young has ever faced. It's pretty minor in the scheme of things. He was the subject of four different criminal investigations. The Ethics Committee let all of that go by without nary a word. It tells me that the Ethics Committee isn't interested in the big issues, the big problems.
The Congressional Ethics Committee would not comment on its investigation into Young beyond the brief statement it released Monday. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is calling for an investigation into why the Justice Department is not prosecuting former VICO executive Bill Allen. He was accused of transporting an underage girl across state lines for sex, a federal crime. Murkowski has expressed frustration and disgust that Allen hasn't been pursued for the alleged offense and told APRN last week she's concerned the Justice Department might be giving him a pass because he helped them out during the trial of the late Senator Ted Stevens. Allen was the government's key witness in that case, which failed after it was revealed prosecutors were concealing evidence from Stevens' lawyers. A Fairbanks militia leader and two other people have pleaded not guilty to federal weapons charges. Militia leader Francis Schaefer Cox, along with Coleman Barney and Lonnie Vernon, were arraigned today in U.S. District Court in Anchorage. The men have been charged with plotting to kill Alaska state troopers and court officials. But the state charges were dropped after a judge determined that audio and video recordings were obtained without a search warrant. Jill Burke is a reporter for Alaska Dispatch and was in the courtroom this morning. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Lori.
Jill, describe the scene this morning in court.
Well, it was pretty standard courtroom scene. We have the judge in from Washington State who's handling the case because of the threats made against the Alaska judge. So he's presiding over everything. And then we had the three defendants seated in their yellow, you know, prison jerseys and pants. Lonnie Vernon, Schaefer Cox, and Coleman Barney, all attended to by their defense attorneys. And then we also had two U.S. prosecutors. And then there were a handful of people in the audience, a large portion of whom, I'd say, you know, four or five were probably reporters, and the others appeared to be court employees of some kind.
Was it quiet and orderly?
It was orderly for the most part. You know, we didn't have any terrible outbursts, or I should say outbursts that were disrupting. Lonnie Vernon, prior to the proceedings beginning, was clearly unhappy about some paperwork that he felt was missing and was trying to get some assistance getting that situation straightened out. During the proceedings themselves, most of the defendants were quite polite to the judge when asked questions. Schaefer Cox interjected a couple of times, but always did so politely.
What specifically is the government accusing Cox of?
In this particular case, unlike in the state's case, it is strictly a weapons case. The men are accused of attempting to obtain illegal weapons on the date of their arrest, silencers and hand grenades. Then recently, Coleman Barney and Schaefer Cox were also indicted on new additional charges, alleging that they also had in their possession prior to the arrest weapons in furtherance of a crime of violence, and with Schaefer Cox, a machine gun, basically that they possessed either illegal weapons or weapons that were illegal to have if they weren't registered.
Besides pleading not guilty, did Schaefer Cox himself have anything to say?
He did. He pleaded not guilty, but then he added that that was not just a procedural formality, that that was his actual assertion of actual innocence on all charges. So he embellished his not guilty plea a little bit at the beginning. And then later on in the proceeding, he asked to address the court and said, look, I am a critic, not a criminal, but it's the government's investigation that has turned me into a crook.
And what about Barney and Vernon? Are they facing the same charges as Schaefer Cox? And did they have anything to say in court?
In this current case, there are 10 counts that are all various weapons counts. Lonnie Vernon is only charged with one of the counts. Schaefer Cox is charged with 8 counts, and Coleman Barney, I think, has 4 or 5. I don't have my notes immediately in front of me. So, no, they're not all facing identical charges. They face up to 70 years in prison if found guilty on all counts for Schaefer Cox. I think it's up to 30 for Barney and up to 5 for Vernon. It's unlikely that if found guilty on all counts, a court would sentence them to all of that time consecutively. But it's possible, and the judge pointed that out to them today.
And Jill, what's next in this case?
There will be a series of motion work, probably related to whether or not evidence will be allowed at trial or whether it should be suppressed. And it's all headed towards a February trial date.
The state had to drop all of their charges. Are they involved in any way in this case now?
They are not. And in fact, the judge asked today whether or not there might yet be additional charges or any similar charges from the state case, which include the, you know, conspiracy to commit kidnapping and murder, whether anything like that might surface in this case. And the prosecutor said no, that they don't intend to file any new or additional charges. And the case that we have today is the case that they intend to bring forward.
All right. Thanks for your help on this, Jill.
Sure thing.
Jill Burke is a reporter with the Alaska Dispatch. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a program that helps University of Alaska students finish their degrees in 4 years.
We do know that this is not possible for every student at UAA, but we do believe that there are some students that are staying here a little longer than they need to.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, NA. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
A proposal that will likely be before the legislature next session is looking for money to enlarge the state's ocean acidification observation network. That would include new monitoring buoys to provide an early warning system that could help avoid an immediate fishing disaster and help determine the long-term impacts of acidification. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Here's the problem with ocean acidification. When there's too much carbon dioxide, or CO2, in the air, too much of it gets into the water. Then CO2 increases the acidity of the seawater, which keeps calcium carbonate from becoming available. Calcium carbonate is what forms the shells of oysters and clams, and the skeletons of many other marine organisms. If that layer of the food chain fails, everything above it will be at risk. Dr. Jeremy Mathis is an assistant professor of chemical oceanography at the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. He says measurements of acid levels are now not much more than a series of snapshots, readings taken when the fishermen or university boats sample water from time to time. That data has shown some alarming trends, but he says it's very hard to put those numbers into context.
What's so great about this buoy network that we've proposed is that these buoys sit in the water 365 days a year. They're making continuous measurements, and they're sending the measurements back in real time to the lab. And so we're getting instantaneous data from them all the time, and it fills in those gaps for us so that we understand not only the seasonal cycles of how the ocean changes over the course of the year, but then we can also see those interannual trends, how the water is changing over those longer timescales.
Two buoys are currently at work, one near Resurrection Bay, the other just to the west of Bristol Bay. But Mathis says the $2.7 million budget request will expand the observation network by three more monitoring stations, one near Kodiak Island, one in Southeast, and one more in the Bering Sea. Legislators are familiar with the need for the project. House Finance Co-Chair Bill Thomas, a fisherman from Haines, says the oceans are critical to a lot of Alaskans. And although he doesn't write the capital project's budget, he will support the project when it comes up.
You know, it protects the wild stock and the hatchery operations that we fish here in Alaska. So $2.7 million, it be worth it.
Mathis says a part of the budget request would go to research, calculating what's likely to happen to acidic levels and their impact on fisheries. He says the data is available.
It won't be easy, but it's something that can be done at this point, that we can actually quantify what the cost of ocean acidification is today, what it'll be 10 years from now, and what it'll be 50 years from now. And I think that's extraordinarily important in terms of thinking about state resources and our fisheries. And the only way we're going to get at that data is if we make an investment and we spend the time and the effort to actually quantify it right now.
Dr. Mathis says the possible effects of ocean acidification are not just speculative. He points to the oyster hatcheries along the coast of Washington and Oregon in 2009. The industry was worth about $85 million to the region's annual economy when the oysters began to fail. Initially, breeders thought the problem was a lethal bacterial strain, but they eventually learned they were circulating acidic water through their facilities.
I don't want that to happen here in Alaska. I think we need to get ahead of that so that we're being proactive in terms of ocean acidification instead of reactive. We don't want to wait to the point to where we see a major fishery start to struggle or even collapse before we start addressing the problem.
The hatcheries were able to avoid financial collapse by putting monitor buoys offshore. When the readings said the water was too acidic, they turned off the external pumps. The Pacific oyster industry is thriving again by taking the measures Mathis suggests Alaska adopt. The university's budget will be included in the spending proposals the governor makes public next month. Mathis hopes the Ocean Acidification Project is part of it. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A study is looking at the health human health effects of climate change in Alaska. The Institute for Circumpolar Health Studies at the University of Alaska Anchorage is 7 months into the year-long project, tracking effects in southeast, interior, and northwest Arctic communities. During a recent teleconference on the study, researcher David Driscoll said the project is taking a unique approach.
One of the entire strategies here has been to try and humanize the environmental risk assessment paradigm as it relates to climate change in Alaska. And really all along, we've been attempting to maintain a participatory model by which members of the communities tell us what they think.
Driscoll is cautious about releasing findings given the study is not complete and feedback may be very seasonal. Fellow researcher Tenaya Sunbury said climate-related impacts also vary according to region.
Some places are going to be drier, some places are going to be wetter, some places are experiencing greater increases in temperature over other places. So that means that we're also seeing different sort of health impacts.
Sunbury said so far she's had the most input from the Northwest Alaska study communities of Point Hope, Kivalina, and Noatak.
Definitely a lot of concern over food security. I heard lots of people concerned about the lack of caribou these past several years. But this year, it was a good caribou season. But then also a lot of insecurity about traveling on the ice.
Sanbury said feedback from the participating interior communities of Anderson, Healy, and Cantwell includes concerns about increased wildfires and allergies. She says there are also mental health impacts.
Concerns and anxiety over the changing ecosystem in the interior. A lot of folks moved out there because they love the land and they wanted to live out their lives in nature. And when they see huge die-offs in trees, and it really impacts them, and I hear about it.
Sunbury says Southeast study participants in Angoon and Ketchikan have reported changes in wildlife and the ability to harvest subsistence foods. Other general climate-related public health concerns include the potential for increases in insects and foodborne illness. The ultimate goal of the climate change health study is to develop locally inspired mitigation strategies. The state is re-examining its cost estimate for the first Alaska-class ferry, and it's likely to come in higher than the total allocated to construction, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Earlier this year, the legislature set aside $60 million for its next generation of ships. That brought funding to a total of $120 million. Many thought it would be enough to design and build the first vessel.
Unfortunately, numbers tend to stick, and $120 million is the number that stuck, so everybody believes that's full funding for the vessel.
Captain Mike Newsell runs the Alaska Marine Highway System. He says the estimate is several years old and may be low.
That may or may not be the case because we're not on contract with anybody for a vessel at that price.
The ferry system has asked Elliott Bay Design Group, its architectural engineering firm, to revise the numbers. Ketchikan's Alaska Ship and Dry Dock will likely build the ship. Newsell says a lot of factors affect the cost.
The price of steel, the cost of labor, the design of the ship, there's a lot of factors that play into that, and whether it's higher or lower, I couldn't really tell you.
He's unsure when the new information will become available. Officials have decided not to take federal funds for the Alaska-class ferry. That would add environmental requirements and block an in-state contract preference. State government is the other source of construction money.
I think one of the issues that we need to keep an eye on is our replacement of the marine ferries.
Sitka lawmaker Bert Stedman assembles the Senate's capital budget as co-chairman of that chamber's finance committee.
And I have been hearing that we might have to put forward a little bit more money for the first one, and that has me a little bit concerned, but clearly we need to have a discussion on when we want to start funding the second one, because we need to build 2 to 3 of these ships and retire our older vessels because of the operational costs.
The first Alaska-class ferry will sail Lynn Canal, linking Juneau, Haines, and Skagway. A second is slated to travel between Ketchikan and Prince Rupert. A third would double up on the Lynn Canal route. The ships will be about 350 feet long and carry up to 500 passengers and about 70 vehicles. They will have crew quarters, but no staterooms, and will not sail overnight. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years. And by AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The University of Alaska Anchorage joined the other campuses of the UA system last month in launching its Stay on Track initiative. The program calls for students to plan their classes and majors to be able to finish their undergraduate degrees in 4 years. APRN's Eric Judson has the story.
Amid the stressful atmosphere of midterm season at UAA, another type of deadline was coming into play. At a campus where less than 9% of students finish their degree in 4 years, staff and faculty statewide saw a need for change. The Stay on Track initiative was born. Kicked off on October 31st, the initiative hopes to bring this graduation rate up. UAA new student orientation director Teresa Lyons was part of the committee tasked with creating the initiative.
We're interested in encouraging our students to enroll and graduate in 4 years. And they can do that by taking a minimum of 30 credits per year, either 15 credits each semester, fall and spring, or 12 credits fall and spring, and then maybe 6 credits in the summer.
Students are directed to the Stay on Track website, which provides them with testimonials from other students, tips for determining a major, and a link to take part in the Finish in 4 Promise, which enters them in a drawing to win prizes if they complete 15 credits this fall semester. Freshman Justice King signed up for the program after he learned about it on UAA's homepage. As a student employee working for the Office of Financial Aid, King says he knows how challenging it is to determine his aspirations.
It's taken years. I'm 24 years old currently, and I went to a vocational school when I was 18 right out of school that did not work out at all. Took years off, went in construction, now came back, decided psychology was more towards what I wanted to go for. Counseling, that kind of thing.
Even choosing a major early in their college career, some students may change majors or decide to continue working on other degree programs. John Budnick is finishing his philosophy degree and has just started another in journalism and public communications.
I didn't know that I wanted to major in philosophy until 2 years into college. I didn't know I wanted to continue on with college until I was coming up on my graduation with philosophy. So college is a resource, you know, it's not a stepping stone. That's how I look at it. It's more of a resource of getting those skill sets that you need to be successful and pursue your career or pursue the person you want to be.
UAA Advising and Testing Center Director Linda Morgan says she understands the Stay on Track program isn't for everyone.
We know that there's a lot of challenges with that because people are not all financially independent. Everybody doesn't have parents that pay for your education, so students have to work. So you have to walk this fine line between not encouraging students to overburden themselves with, say, 15 credits and working 30 hours a week. That won't get it. But on the other hand, we recognize that if students don't make a commitment to their education and get some momentum going, they're going to get discouraged because the goal will feel too far off.
In fact, new student orientation director Lyons says the program takes this into account.
We do know that this is not possible for every student at UAA, but we do believe that there are some students that are staying here a little longer than they need to, and they could actually save $10,000 if they were to graduate in 4 years instead of completing it in 5.
Budnick, meanwhile, will continue going to school to get the degree he wants. He says he doesn't understand the stigma of finishing a degree in 4 years.
I know a lot of people go to school for 7 years and they're called doctors, but, you know, it's okay, too, if you're not going to become a doctor and go to school for 7 years, because it's about finishing, not finishing on time.
Since the launch of Stay on Track at the end of October, 54 students have made the Finish in 4 promise. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Eric Judson.
Most communities in Alaska don't have big box stores, but that doesn't mean residents in those places couldn't participate in Black Friday. KSTK Charlotte Duren talked to business owners and shoppers in downtown Wrangell and has this story.
When you hear Black Friday, you probably think of massive crowds piling into a Best Buy superstore to get those cheap electronics, or people being trampled at a Walmart for the new big toy. Well, Wrangell doesn't have either of those places, but it does have local retailers, who every year kick off the day after Thanksgiving shopping with sales and deals.
Are you taking advantage of Black Friday here in Wrangell?
Betsy is. I'm just following her around.
What are you guys picking up?
Let me see. What did I get?
Jeans.
I got jeans and a Wrangell Wolves t-shirt.
Shopping for out-of-town relatives that used to live in Alaska, so they like Alaska stuff.
Black Friday started out a little slow because of the snow and everything, and I believe people are starting to show up now, so that's always good.
That's local shoppers and retailer Ernie Christian. Christian says Audison's True Value store began advertising their store sales early in November, and says Audison's had a good turnout of shoppers on Friday. Same goes for Angerman's Inc. down the street.
Every dollar that is spent in Wrangell circulates around many, many times over, and so we really appreciate our customers.
That's local business owner Jeff Angerman. Angerman says competing with online shopping is a reality for many businesses in Wrangell, but says he's fortunate to have loyal and dedicated customers.
There's a lot of people out, and everybody knows about Black Friday. And so, I'd say it's a pretty good day considering the way the weather's been and the road situation that I'm happy.
The roads in front of Angerman's store are paved and open for public parking. Last-minute work on the downtown revitalization project is scheduled for this week before the winter shutdown begins. Angerman says the roads will be open for the Midnight Madness shopping event on Friday. This comes as a relief to shopper Leslie Cummings.
Very happy with the road situation that we can get to our stores without going through a detour, you know, taking your life in your own hands, and just enjoying Wrangell and being home.
Coming up this Friday, December 2nd, is Midnight Madness in Wrangell. All of the stores will be open until 10 p.m., as well as a tree lighting ceremony downtown starting at 6 p.m. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Charlotte Duren.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Eric Judson in Anchorage, and Charlotte Duren in Wrangell. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.